It reminded her of Venice. She wondered if there had been a strain there once.
It has no address, he said.
That's impossible, Shea said. He said nothing.
She thought about what she'd found when she'd opened the Sea-Tac duty-free bag.
Something flat and rectangular,
dark gray.
Maybe made from one of those weird plastics that had metal in them. One end had rows of little holes. The other had complicated shapes, metal, and a different kind of plastic.
There didn't seem to be any way to open it.
No visible seams, no markings.
Didn't rattle when she shook it.
Maybe What Things Are, the icon dictionary, would recognize it. But she hadn't had time. Masahiko had been downstairs changing when she'd slipped the blue and yellow plastic with Mitsuko's serially numbered commemorative low-res Swiss Army knife. She'd glanced around the room for a hiding place. Everything too neat and tidy. Finally, she'd put it back in her bag, hearing him coming up the stairs from the kitchen, which was where it was now, along with her sandbenders under her arm as they entered the station, which was probably not smart, but she just didn't know. She used Kelsey's cash card to buy them both tickets. Arlie.
There was a fax from Rydell waiting for Lainey when Blackwell dropped him at the hotel. It had been printed on expensive-looking gray letterhead that contrasted drastically with the body of the fax itself, which had been sent from a Lucky Dragon 24-hour convenience store on Sunset. The smiling Lucky Dragon, blowing smoke from its nostrils, was centered just below the hotel's silver-embossed logo, something Lainey thought of as the droopy evil elf hat. Whatever it was supposed to be, the hotel's decorators were very fond of it. It formed a repeating motif in the lobby, and Lainey was glad that it didn't seem to have reached the guest rooms yet. Rydell had hand-printed his fax with a medium-width fiber pen in scrupulously neat block capital. Lainey read it in the elevator. It was addressed to C. Lainey, guest. I think they know where you are. She and the day manager had coffee in the lobby, and he kept looking at me. He could have checked the phone log easy. Wish I hadn't called you there. Sorry. Anyway, then she and the others checked out, fast, left the techs to pack up. A tech called Genghis in the garage that some of them were on their way to Japan, and he was glad he wasn't. Watch out, okay? Rydell. Okay, Lainey said, and remembered how he'd walked to the Lucky Dragon one night against Rydell's advice because he couldn't sleep. There were scary-looking bionic hookers posted every block or so, but otherwise it hadn't felt too dangerous. Someone had painted a memorial mural to J.D. Shapley on one side of the Lucky Dragon, and the management had had the good sense to leave it there, culturally integrating their store into the actual 24-hour life of the strip. You could buy a burrito there, a lottery ticket, batteries, tests for various diseases. You could do voicemail, email, send faxes. It had occurred to Lainey that this was probably the only store for miles that sold anything that anyone ever really needed. The others all sold things that he couldn't even imagine wanting. He reread the fax, walking down the corridor, and used the card key to open his door. There was a shallow wicker basket on the bed, spread with white tissue and unfamiliar objects. On closer inspection, these proved to be his socks and underwear, freshly laundered and arranged in little paper holders embossed with the elf hat. He opened the narrow mirrored closet door, activating a built-in light, and discovered his shirts arranged on hangers, including the blue button-downs Kathy Torrance had made fun of. They looked brand new. He touched one of the lightly starched cuffs. Stitch count, he said. He looked down at Rydell's folded fax. He imagined Kathy Torrance headed straight for him on an SST from Los Angeles. He discovered that he couldn't imagine her sleeping. He'd never seen her asleep, and somehow it didn't seem like something she'd willingly do. In the weird vibrationless quiet of supersonic flight, she'd be staring at the gray blank of the window or at the screen of her computer, thinking of him. The screen behind him came on with a soft chime, and he jumped 4 inches straight up. He turned and saw the BBC logo. Yamazaki's second video. He was a third of the way through it when the door chimed.
Rez was strolling along a narrow trail in the jungle somewhere, wearing sun-bleached khakis and rope-soled sandals. He was singing something as he went, a wordless little melody, over and over, trying different tones and stresses. His bare chest shone with sweat, and when the open shirt swung aside, you'd catch a corner of his I Ching tattoo. He had a length of bamboo and swung it as he walked, swatting at dangling vines. Laney had a sneaking suspicion that the wordless melody had subsequently turned into some global billion seller, but he couldn't place it yet. The door chimed again. He got up, crossed to the door, thumbed the speaker button. Yes? Hello? A woman's voice. He touched the card-sized screen set into the door frame and saw a dark-haired woman. Bang. The tech from the appliance warehouse. He unlocked the door and opened it. Yamazaki thinks we should talk, she said. Laney saw that she was wearing a black suit with a narrow skirt, dark stockings. Aren't you supposed to be shopping for a van? He stepped back to let her in. Got one, closing the door behind her. When a low-res machine decides to throw money at a problem, money will be thrown, usually in the wrong direction. She looked at the screen where Rez was still swinging along, swatting flies from his neck and chest, lost in composition. Homework? Yamazaki. Arlie McRae, she said, taking a card from a small black purse and handing it to him. Her name there, then four telephone numbers and two addresses, neither of them physical. Do you have a card, Mr. Laney?
Colin, no, I don't.
They can make them up for you at the desk. Everyone has a card here. He put the card in his shirt pocket.
Blackwell didn't give me one, neither did Yamazaki.
Outside the low-res organization, I mean. It's like not having socks.
I have socks, Laney said, indicating the basket on the bed. Do you feel like watching a BBC documentary on low-res?
No.
I don't think I can turn it off. He'll know.
Try lowering the volume. Manually.
She demonstrated. A technician, Laney said.
With a van. An umpty million yen worth of equipment that didn't seem to do much for you.
She sat down in one of the room's two small armchairs, crossing her legs. Laney took the other chair. Not your fault. You got me in there just fine. But it's not the kind of data I can work with.
Yamazaki told me what you're supposed to be able to do, she said. I didn't believe him.
Laney looked at her. I can't help you there. There were three smiling suns, like black woodblock prints down the inside of her left calf.
They're woven into the stocking. Catalan.
Laney looked up. I hope you're not going to ask me to explain what it is people think they pay me to do, he said. Because I can't. I don't know.
Don't worry, she said. I just work here. But what I'm being paid to do right now is determine what it is we could give you that would allow you to do whatever it is that you're alleged to be able to do.
Laney looked at the screen. Concert footage now. And Rez was dancing, a microphone in his hand. You've seen this video, right? Is he serious about that Sino-Celtic thing he was talking about in that interview?
You haven't met him yet, have you?
No.
It's not the easiest thing, deciding what Rez is serious about.
But how can there be Sino-Celtic mysticism when the Chinese and the Celts don't have any shared history?
Because Rez himself is half Chinese and half Irish. And if there's one thing he's serious about...
Yes.
It's Rez. Laney stared glumly at the screen as the singer was replaced by a close-up of Lowe's playing, his hands on the black-bodied guitar. Earlier, a venerable British guitarist in wonderful tweeds had opined as how they hadn't really expected the next Hendrix to emerge from Taiwanese canto pop. But then again, they hadn't actually been expecting the first one, had they? Yamazaki told me the story. What happened to you?
Arlie McRae said.
Up to a certain point.
Laney closed his eyes.
The show never aired, Laney. Out of Control dropped it. What happened?
He'd taken to having breakfast beside the chateau's small oval pool, past the homely clabbered bungalows that Rydell said were a later addition. It was the one time of the day that felt like his own. Or did, until Rice Daniels arrived, which was usually toward the bottom of a 3-cup pot of coffee, just prior to his eggs and bacon.
Daniels would cross the terracotta to Laney's table with what could only be described as a spring in his step. Laney privately wished to ascribe this to drug use, of which he'd seen no evidence whatever, and indeed Daniels's most potent public indulgence seemed to be multiple cups of decaf espresso taken with curls of lemon peel. He favored loosely woven beige suits and collarless shirts. This particular morning, however, Daniels had not been alone, and Laney had detected a lack of temper in the accustomed spring, a certain jangled brittleness there, and the painful-looking glasses seemed to grip his head even more tightly than usual. Beside him came a gray-haired man in a dark brown suit of Western cut, hawk-faced and wind-burnt, the blade of his impressive nose protruding from a huge black pair of sunglasses. He wore black alligator roping boots and carried a dusty-looking briefcase of age-darkened tan cowhide, its handle mended with what Laney supposed had to be baling wire. "Laney," Rice Daniels had said, arriving at the table, "this is Aaron Pursley."
"Don't get up, son,"
Pursley said, though Laney hadn't thought to.
"Fellas is bringing you your breakfast."
One of the Mongolian waiters was crossing with a tray from the direction of the bungalows. Pursley put his battle-scarred briefcase down and took one of the white-painted metal chairs. The waiter served Laney's eggs. Laney signed for them, adding a 15% tip. Pursley was flipping through the contents of his case. He wore half a dozen heavy silver rings on the fingers of either hand, some of them studded with turquoise. Laney couldn't remember when he'd last seen anyone carry around that much paper.
"You're the lawyer," Laney said.
"On television."
"In the flesh as well, son."
Pursley was on Cops in Trouble, and before that he'd been famous for defending celebrity clients. Daniels hadn't taken a seat, and stood behind Pursley now with a hunched, uncharacteristic posture, hands in his trouser pocket.
"Here we are," Pursley said.
He drew out a sheaf of blue paper.
"Don't let your eggs get cold."
"Have a seat," Laney said to Daniels. Daniels winced behind his glasses.
"Now," Pursley said, "you were in a federal orphanage in Gainesville, it says here, from age 12 to age 17.
Laney looked at his eggs.
"That's right. During that time, you participated in a number of drug trials. You were an experimental subject?"
"Yes," Laney said, his eggs looking somehow farther away, or like a picture in a magazine.
"This was voluntary on your part?"
"There were rewards."
"Voluntary,"
Pursley said.
"You get on any of that 5SB? "They didn't tell us what they were giving us," Laney said. "Sometimes we'd get a placebo instead." "You don't mistake 5SB for any placebo, son, but I think you know that."
Which was true, but Laney just sat there.
"Well?"
Pursley removed his big, heavy glasses. His eyes were cold and blue, and set into an intricate topography of wrinkles. "I probably had it," Laney said. Pursley slapped the blue papers on his thigh.
"Well, there you are. You almost certainly did. Now, do you know how that substance eventually affected many of the test subjects?"
Daniels unclamped his glasses and began to knead the bridge of his nose. His eyes were closed.
"Stuff tends to turn males into fixated homicidal stalkers," Pursley said, putting his glasses back on and stuffing the papers into his case. "Comes on years later sometimes. Go after media faces, politicians. That's why it's now one of the most illegal substances in a damn country you care to look. Drug that makes folks want to stalk and kill politicians, well, boy, it'll get to be."
He grinned dryly.
"I'm not one," Laney said. "I'm not like that."
Daniels opened his eyes. "It doesn't matter," he said. "What matters is that SlitScan can counter all our material by raising the possibility, the merest shadow, however remote, that you are."
"You see, son," Pursley said, "they just make out you got into your line of work because you were predisposed to that, spying on famous people. You didn't tell them about any of it, did you?"
"No," Laney said. "I didn't."
"There you go,"
said Pursley.
They'll say they hired you because you were good at it. But you just got too damn good at it.
But she wasn't famous, Laney said.
But he is, Rice Daniels said. And they'll say you were after him. They'll say the whole thing was your idea. They'll wring their hands about responsibility. They'll talk about their new screening procedures for quantitative analysts. And nobody, Laney, nobody at all, will be watching us.
That's about the size of it,
Pursley said, standing. He picked up the briefcase.
That real bacon there, like off a hog.
They say it is, Laney said.
Damn,
Pursley said.
These Hollywood hotels are fast lane.
He stuck out his hand. Laney shook it.
Nice meeting you, son.
Daniels didn't even bother to say goodbye. And 2 days later, going over the printout of his charges, Laney would notice that it all began, the billing in his own name, with a large pot of coffee, scrambled eggs and bacon, and a 15% tip. Arlie McRae was staring at him.
Do they know that?
She asked. Is Blackwell?
No,
Laney said. Not that part, anyway. He could see Rydell's fax folded on the bedside stand. They didn't know about that, either.
What happened then? What did you do?
I found out I was paying for at least some of the lawyers they'd gotten for me. I didn't know what to do. I sat out there by the pool a lot. It was sort of pleasant, actually. I wasn't thinking about anything in particular. Know what I mean?
Maybe,
she said.
Then I heard about this job from one of the security people at the hotel.
She slowly shook her head.
What?
He said.
Never mind,
she said.
You make about as much sense as the rest of it. Probably you'll fit right in.
Into what? She looked at her watch. Black-faced stainless on a plain black nylon band.
Dinner's at 8, but Rez will be late. Come out for a walk and a drink. I'll try to tell you what I know about it.
If you want to, Laney said.
They're paying me to do it, she said, getting up. And it probably beats wrestling large pieces of high-end electronics up and down escalators.
Monkey boxing. Between stations, there was a gray shudder beyond the windows of the silent train. Not as of surfaces rushing past, but as if particulate matter were being vibrated there at some crucial rate just prior to the emergence of a new order of being. Chia and Masahiko had found two seats between a trio of plaid-skirted schoolgirls and a businessman who was reading a fat Japanese comic. There was a woman on the cover with her breasts bound up like balls of twine, but conically, the nipples protruding like the popping eyes of a cartoon victim. Chia noticed that the artist had devoted much more time to drawing the twine, exactly how it was wrapped and knotted, than to drawing the breasts themselves. The woman had sweat running down her face and was trying to back away from someone or something cut off by the edge of the cover. Masahiko undid the top two buttons of his tunic and withdrew a 6-inch square of something black and rigid, no thicker than a pane of glass. He brushed it purposefully with the fingers of his right hand, beaded lines of colored light appearing at his touch. Though these were fainter here, washed out by the train's directionless fluorescence, Chia recognized the square as the control face of the computer she'd seen in his room. He studied the display, stroked it again, and frowned at the result.
Someone pays attention to my address, he said, and to Mitsuko's.
The restaurant?
Our user addresses.
What kind of attention?
I do not know. We are not linked. Except by me.
Tell me about sandbenders, Masahiko said, putting the control face away and buttoning his tunic.
It started with a woman who was an interface designer, Chia said, glad to change the subject. Her husband was a jeweler, and he died of that nerve attenuation thing before they saw how to fix it. But he'd been a big green, too, and he hated the way consumer electronics were made, a couple of little chips and boards inside these plastic shells. The shells were just point-of-purchase eye candy, he said, made to wind up in the landfill if nobody recycled it, and usually nobody did. So before he got sick, he used to tear up her hardware, the designer, and put the real parts into cases he'd make in his shop. Say he'd make a solid bronze case for a mini-disc unit, ebony inlays, carved the control surfaces out of fossil ivory, turquoise, rock crystal. It weighed more, sure, but it turned out a lot of people liked that. Like they had their music or their memory, whatever, in something that felt like it was there. And people liked touching all that stuff. Metal, a smooth stone. And once you had the case, when the manufacturer brought out a new model, well, if the electronics were any better, you just pulled the old ones out and put the new ones in your case. So you still had the same object, just with better function.
Masahiko's eyes were closed, and he seemed to be nodding slightly, though perhaps only with the motion of the train.
And it turned out some people liked that, too, liked it a lot. He started getting commissions to make these things. One of the first was for a keyboard, and the keys were cut from the keys of an old piano with the numbers and letters in silver. But then he got sick.
Masahiko's eyes opened, and she saw that not only had he been listening, but that he was impatient for more.
So after he was dead, the software designer started thinking about all that, and how she wanted to do something that took what he'd been doing into something else. So she cashed out her stock in all the companies she'd worked for, and she bought some land on the coast in Oregon.
And the train pulled into Shinjuku, and everyone stood up heading for the doors, the businessman closing his breast bondage comic and tucking it beneath his arm. Chia was leaning back to look at the strangest building she'd ever seen. It was shaped like the old-fashioned idea of a robot, a simplified human figure, its legs and upraised arms made of transparent plastic over a framework of metal. Its torso appeared to be of brick, in red, yellow, and blue, arranged in simple patterns. Escalators, stairways, and looping slides twisted through the hollow limbs, and puffs of white smoke emerged at regular intervals from the rectangular mouth of the thing's enormous face. Beyond it, the sky all gray and pressing down. Tetsujin building, Masahiko said. Monkey boxing was not there.
What is it?
Osaka Tin Toy Institute, he said. Monkey boxing this way. He was consulting the swarming squiggles on his control face. He pointed along the street, past a fast food franchise called California Reich. Its trademark, a stylized stainless steel palm tree against one of those twisted cross things like the mesh backs had drawn on their hands in her class on European history. Which had pissed the teacher off totally, but Chia couldn't remember them drawing any palm trees. Then two of them had gotten into a fight over which way you were supposed to draw the twisted parts on the cross, pointing left or pointing right, and one of them had zapped the other with a stun gun, the kind they were always making out of those disposable flash cameras, and the teacher had to call the police. Ninth floor. Wet Leaves Fortune building, he said. He set off down the crowded pavement.
Chia followed, wondering how long jet lag lasted, and how you were supposed to separate it from just being tired.
Maybe what she was feeling now was what her civics program at her last school had called culture shock.
She felt like everything, every little detail of Tokyo was just different enough to create a kind of pressure, something that built up against her eyes, as though they'd grown tired of having to notice all the differences. A little sidewalk tree that was dressed up in a sort of woven basketwork jacket, the neon avocado color of a payphone.
A serious-looking girl with round glasses and a gray sweatshirt that said, Free Vagina.
She'd been keeping her eyes extra wide to take all these things in, like they'd be processed eventually. But now her eyes were tired, and the differences were starting to back up.
At the same time, she felt that if she squinted, maybe just the right way, she could make all this turn back into Seattle, some downtown part she'd walked through with her mother.
Homesick.
The strap of her bag digging into her shoulder each time her left foot came down. Masahiko turned a corner. There didn't seem to be alleys in Tokyo, not in the sense that there were smaller streets behind the big streets, the places where they put out the garbage, and there weren't any stores. There were smaller streets and smaller ones behind those, but you couldn't guess what you'd find there. A shoe repair place, an expensive-looking hair salon, a chocolate maker, a magazine stand where she noticed a copy of that same creepy comic with the woman all wrapped up like that. Another corner and they were back on what she took to be a main street. Cars here, anyway. She watched one turn into a street-level opening and vanish. Her scalp prickled. What if that were the way up to Eddie's club? That whiskey club,
That was right around here, wasn't it? How big was this Shinjuku place, anyway?
What if the Graceland pulled up beside her?
What if Eddie and Mary Alice were out looking for her?
They were passing the opening the car had disappeared into. She looked in and saw that it was a kind of gas station.
Where is it?
She asked. Wet Leaves Fortune, he said, pointing up. Tall and narrow, square signs jutting out at the corners of each floor.
It looked like almost all the others, but she thought Eddie's had been bigger. How do we get up there?
He led her into a kind of lobby, a ground floor arcade lined with tiny stall-like shops. Too many lights, mirrors, things for sale, all blurring together. Into a cramped elevator that smelled of stale smoke. He said something in Japanese and the door closed. The elevator sang them a little song to tinkling music. Masahiko looked irritated. At the ninth floor, the door opened on a dust-covered man with a black headband sagging over his eye. He looked at Chia.
If you're the one from the magazine, he said, you're 3 days early.
He pulled the headband off and wiped his face with it. Chia wasn't sure if he was Japanese or not, or what age he might be. His eyes were brown, spectacularly bloodshot under deep brows, and his black hair, pulled straight back and secured by the band, was streaked with gray. Behind him there was a constant banging and confusion, men yelling in Japanese, someone pushing a high-sided orange plastic cart crammed with folded plaster-flecked cables, shards of plastic painted with gold gilt and Chinese red. Part of a suspended ceiling let go with a twanging of wires, crashed to the floor. More cries.
I'm looking for monkey boxing, Chia said.
Darling, the man said, you're a bit late.
He wore a black paper coverall, its sleeves torn off at the elbows, revealing arms tracked with blobby blue lines and circles. Some kind of faux primitive decoration. He wiped his eyes and squinted at her.
You aren't from the magazine in London?
No, Chia said.
No,
he agreed.
You seem a bit young even for them.
This is monkey boxing?
Another section of ceiling came down. The dusty man squinted at her.
Where did you say you were from?
Seattle.
You heard about monkey boxing in Seattle?
Yes.
He smiled wanly.
That's fun. Heard about it in Seattle. You're on the club scene yourself, dear?
I'm Chia McKenzie.
Jun. I'm called Jun, dear. Owner, designer, DJ. But you're too late. Sorry. All that's left of monkey boxing's going out in these gomi carts. Landfill now, like every other broken dream. Had a lovely run while it lasted, better part of 3 months. You heard about our Shaolin Temple theme? That whole warrior monk thing?
He sighed extravagantly.
It was heaven. Every instant of it. The Okinawan bartenders shaved their heads after the first 3 nights and started to wear the orange robes. I surpassed myself in the booth. It was a vision, you understand? But that's the nature of the floating world, isn't it? We are in the water trade, after all, and one tries to be philosophical. But who is your friend here? I like his hair.
Masahiko Mimura, Chia said.
I like that black-clad boho butch bed-sit thing, the man said. Mishima and Dietrich on the same half-shell if it's done right.
Masahiko frowned. If monkey boxing is gone, Chia said, what will you do now?
Jun retied his headband. He looked less pleased.
Another club, but I won't be designing. They'll say I've sold out. Suppose I have. I'll still be managing the space, very nice salary, and an apartment along with it. But the concept...
He shrugged.
Were you here the night Rez told him he wanted to marry the idol?
His brow creased behind the headband.
I had to sign... agreements,
he said.
You aren't from the magazine?
No.
If he hadn't come in that night, I suppose we might still be up and running. And really, he wasn't the sort of thing we'd tried to be about. We had Maria Paz just after she'd split up with her boyfriend, the public relations monster, and the press were thick as flies. She's huge here, did you know that? And we'd had Blue Ahmed from Chrome Koran, and the press scarcely noticed. Rez and his friends, though. Press was not a problem. Sent in this big minder who looked as though he'd been using his face as a chopping block. Came up to me and said Rez had heard about the place and was about to drop in with a few friends, and could we arrange a table with a bit of privacy? Well, really, I had to think, Rez, who? Then it clicked, of course, and I said, fine, absolutely. And we put three tables together in the back, and even borrowed a purple cordon from the Goomy Boys in the hostess place upstairs. And he came? Rez?
Absolutely.
An hour later, there he is, smiling, shaking hands, signing things, if you asked him to, though there wasn't too burning a demand, actually. Four women with him, two other men, if you didn't count the minder. Very nice black suit. Yoji. Bit the worse for wear. Rez, I mean. Been out to dinner, it looked like. Had a few drinks with it. Certain amount of laughter, if you follow me.
He turned and said something to one of the workmen, who wore shoes like two-toed black leather socks. Chia, who had no idea what monkey boxing had actually been about, imagined Rez at a table with some other people, behind a purple rope, and in the foreground a crowd of Japanese people doing whatever Japanese people did at a club like that. Dancing?
Then our boy gets up. He's going to the toilet. The big minder makes as if he's getting up to go too, but our boy waves him back. Big laugh from the table. Big minder, not too happy. Two of the women start to get up like they're going with him. He'll have none of it. Waves them back. More laughter. Not that anyone else was paying him that much attention. I was going into the booth in 5 minutes with a set of extremely raw North Africans. Had to judge the crowd, get on it with them, know just when to drop it in. But there he went, right through them, and only one or two even noticed, and they didn't stop dancing.
What kind of club was it?
Where nobody would stop dancing for Rez.
So I was thinking about my set, the order of it, and suddenly he's right in front of me. Big grin. Eyes funny, though I wouldn't swear it was anything he'd done in the toilet, if you know what I mean.
Chia nodded her head. What did he mean?
And would I mind, he said, hand on my shoulder, if he just spoke briefly to the crowd. Said he'd been thinking about something for a long time, and now he'd made up his mind, and he wanted to tell people. And the big minder just materialized there, wanting to know, was there any problem? None at all, Rez says, giving my shoulder a squeeze. But he was just going to have a word with the crowd.
Chia looked at Jun's shoulder, wondering which one had been squeezed by Rez's actual hand.
So he did,
Jun said. But what did he say? Chia asked.
A load of bollocks, dear. Evolution and technology and passion. Man's need to find beauty in the emerging order. His own burning need to get his end in with some software dolly wank toy. Ball. Ah, sir.
He pushed his headband up with his thumb, but it fell back.
And because he did that, opened his mouth up in my club, low slash bloody Rez bought my club. Bought me as well, and I've signed agreements that I won't talk to any of you about any of that. And now if you and your charming friend will excuse me, darling, I have work to do.
Standover Man. There was a man on stilts at the intersection nearest the hotel. He wore a hooded white paper suit, a gas mask, and a pair of rectangular signboards. Messages scrolled down the boards in Japanese as he shifted his weight to maintain balance. Streams of pedestrian traffic flowed around and past him. What's that? Laney asked, indicating the man on stilts.
A sect,
Arlie McRae said.
New logic. They say the world will end when the combined weight of all the human nervous tissue on the planet reaches a specific figure.
A very long multi-digit number went scrolling down.
Is that it? Laney asked.
No, she said. That's their latest estimate of the current total weight.
She'd gone back to her room for the black coat she now wore, leaving Laney to change into clean socks, underwear, a blue shirt.
He didn't have a tie, so he'd button the shirt at the collar and put his jacket back on. He'd wondered if everyone who worked for Lo-Rez stayed in that same hotel. Laney saw the man's eyes through the transparent visor as they passed, a look of grim patience. The stilts were the kind workers wore to put up ceilings, articulated alloy sprung with steel.
What's supposed to happen when there's enough nervous tissue?
A new order of being. They don't talk about it. Rez was interested in them, apparently. He tried to arrange an audience with the founder.
And?
The founder declined. He said that Rez made his living through the manipulation of human nervous tissue, and that that made him untouchable.
Rez was unhappy?
Not according to Blackwell. Blackwell said it seemed to cheer him up a little.
He's not cheerful ordinarily.
Laney sidestepped to avoid a bicycle someone was wheeling in the opposite direction. Let's say that the things that bother Rez aren't the things that bother most people. Laney noticed a dark green van edging along beside them. Its wraparound windows were mirrored, its neon license plates framed with animated tubes of mini-Vegas twinklers.
I think we're being followed, he said.
We'd better be. I wanted the kind with the weird chrome curb feelers that make them look like silverfish, but I had to settle for custom license plate trim. Where you go, it goes. And parking around here is probably more of a challenge than anything you'll be expected to do tonight. Now, she said, down here.
Steep, narrow stairs, walled with an alarming pink mosaic of glistening, tonsil-like nodules. Laney hesitated, then saw a sign. The letters made up of hundreds of tiny pastel oblongs.
Le Chicle. Stepping down, he lost sight of the van. A chewing gum theme bar, he thought. And then, I'm getting too used to this.
But he still avoided touching the wall of chewed gum as he followed her down.
Into powdery pinks and grays. But these impersonating the unchewed product, wall-wide slabs of it, hung with archaic signage from the nation of his birth, screen-printed steel, framed and ancient cardboard, cunningly lit, icons of gum. Bazooka Joe featured centrally, a figure unknown to Laney, but surely no more displaced.
Come here often? Laney asked, as they took stools with bulbous cushions in a particularly lurid bubblegum pink.
The bar was laminated with thousands of rectangular chewing gum wrappers. Yes, she said, but mainly because it's unpopular, and it's non-smoking, which is still kind of special here.
What's black black? Laney asked,
looking at a framed poster depicting a stylized 1940s automobile hurtling through the faint suggestion of city street. Aside from black black, it was lettered in a sort of Art Deco Japanese. Gum. You can still buy it, she said. The cab drivers all chew it. Lots of caffeine.
In gum?
They sell pick-me-ups here full of liquid nicotine.
I think I'll have a beer instead.
When the waitress, in tiny silver shorts and a prehensile pink angora top, had taken their orders, Arlie opened her purse and removed a notebook. These are linear topographies of some of the structures you accessed earlier today. She passed Laney the notebook. They're in a format called Realtree 7.2.
Laney clicked through a series of images, abstract geometrics arranged in vanishing linear perspective. I don't know how to read them, he said.
She poured her sake. You really were trained by Dad America?
I was trained by a bunch of Frenchmen who like to play tennis.
Realtree's from Dad America. The best quantitative analysis software they've got.
She closed the notebook, put it back in her purse.
Laney poured his beer.
Ever hear of something called TIDAL?
TIDAL?
Acronym, maybe.
No. She lifted the china cup and blew, like a child cooling tea.
It was another Dad America tool, or the start of one. I don't think it reached the market. But that was how I learned to find the nodal point.
Okay, she said. What are the nodal points?
Laney looked at the bubbles on the surface of his beer. It's like seeing things in clouds, Laney said, except the things you see are really there.
She put her sake down. Yamazaki promised me you weren't crazy.
It's not crazy. It's something to do with how I process low-level broad-spectrum input. Something to do with pattern recognition.
And SlitScan hired you on the basis of that?
They hired me when I demonstrated that it works. But I can't do that with the kind of data you showed me today.
Why not? Laney raised his beer.
Because it's like trying to have a drink with a bank. It's not a person. It doesn't drink. There's no place for it to sit.
He drank.
Rez doesn't generate patterns I can read, because everything he does is at one remove. It's like looking in an annual report for the personal habits of the chairman of the board. It's not going to be there. From the outside, it just looks like that real tree stuff. If I enter a specific area, I don't get any sense of how the data there relates to the rest of it. See? It's got to be relational. He drummed his fingers on the laminated gum wrappers.
Somewhere in Ireland.
Guest house with a beach view. Nobody there. Records of how it was kept stocked. Stuff for the bathroom, toothpaste, shaving foam.
I've been there, she said. That's on an estate he bought from an older musician, an Irishman. It's beautiful. Like Italy, in a way.
You think he'll take this Ida Roo back there when they get hitched?
Nobody has any idea what he's talking about when he says he wants to marry her.
Then an apartment in Stockholm. Huge, great big stoves in each room made of glazed ceramic bricks.
I don't know that one. He has places all over, and some of them are kept very quiet. There's another country place in the south of France, a house in London, apartments in New York, Paris, Barcelona. I was working out of the Catalan office, reformatting all their stuff, and Spain's as well, when this Ida Roo thing hit. I've been here ever since.
But you know him? You knew him before?
He's the navel of the world I work in, Laney. That has a way of making people unknowable.
What about Lowe?
Quiet. Very. Bright. Very. She frowned at her sake. I don't think any of it's ever really gotten to Lowe. He seems to regard their entire career as some freak event unrelated to anything else.
Including his partner deciding to marry a software agent?
Lowe told me a story once about a job he'd had. He worked for a soup vendor in Hong Kong, a wagon on the sidewalk. He said the wagon had been in business for over 50 years, and their secret was that they'd never cleaned the kettle. In fact, they'd never stopped cooking the soup. It was the same seafood soup they'd been selling for 50 years, but it was never the same, because they added fresh ingredients every day, depending on what was available. He said that was what his career as a musician felt like, and he liked that about it. Blackwell says if Rez were more like Lowe, he'd still be in prison.
Why?
Blackwell was serving a 9-year sentence in an Australian maximum security prison when Rez talked his way in to give a concert. Just Rez. Lowe and the others thought it was too dangerous. They'd been warned that it could turn into a hostage-taking situation. The prison authorities refused to take any responsibility, and they wanted it in writing. Rez signed anything they put in front of him. His security people resigned on the spot. He went in with 2 guitars, a wireless mic, and a very basic amplification system. During the concert, a riot broke out. Apparently, it was orchestrated by a group of Italian prisoners from Melbourne. 5 of them took Rez into the prison laundry, which they'd chosen because it was windowless and easily defended. They informed Rez they were going to kill him if they couldn't negotiate their release in exchange for his. They discussed cutting off at least one of his fingers to demonstrate that they meant business, or possibly some more intimate part, though that may simply have been to make him more anxious. Which it did.
She signaled the pink Angora waitress for more sake.
Blackwell, who'd evidently been extremely irritated at the interruption of the concert, which he'd been enjoying enormously, appeared in the laundry approximately 40 minutes after Rez was taken prisoner. Neither Rez nor the Italians saw him arrive, and the Italians definitely hadn't been expecting him. She paused. He killed 3 of them with a tomahawk. Put the end of it into their heads. 1, 2, 3, Rez says, like that. No fuss, whatever.
A tomahawk?
Sort of narrow-bladed hatchet with a spike opposite the blade. Extends the reach, imparts terrific force, and with practice can be thrown with considerable accuracy. Blackwell swears by it. The other 2 fled, although they both seem to have died in the aftermath of the riot. Personally, I'm sure Blackwell or his mates killed them, because he was never charged with the murder of the other 3. The sole surviving witness was Rez, whom Blackwell escorted to the barricade the guards had erected in the exercise yard. Her sake arrived. It took Rez's lawyers 3 months to get Blackwell's sentence reversed on a technicality. They've been together ever since.
What was Blackwell in for?
Murder, she said. Do you know what a standover man is?
No.
It's a peculiarly Australian concept. I'm tempted to think it could only have grown out of a culture comprised initially of convicts, but my Australian friends don't buy that. The standover man is a loner, a predator who preys on other, more prosperous criminals, often extremely dangerous ones. He captures them and stands over them to extort money.
What's that mean?
He tortures them until they tell him where their money is. And these are often fairly serious operators with people paid to take care of them, specifically to prevent this sort of thing.
Tortures them.
Toe cutter is a related term. When they tell him what he needs to know, he kills them.
And Blackwell was suddenly and noiselessly and simply there, very black and matte, in an enormous waxed cotton drover's coat. Behind him, the faded American advertising and the grays and pinks of gum, his fretted scalp concealed by the waxed cotton crown of a broad black hat.
Ollie, dear, you wouldn't take the name in vain, would you?
But he smiled at her.
I'm explaining your earlier career to Mr. Laney, Blackwell. I'd only just gotten up to the massage parlor, and now you've ruined it.
Never mind.
Dinner's been moved up at the request of his Rosa. I'm here to take you. Change of venue as well. Hope you don't mind.
Where? Arlie said, as if not yet prepared to move.
The Western world, said Blackwell. And me in my good shoes, she said.
22. Gomi Boy. The train's more crowded now, standing room only. Everyone pressed in tight, and somehow the eye contact rules were different here. But she wasn't sure how. Her bag with the sandbenders was jammed up against Masahiko's back. He was looking at the control face again, holding it up the way a commuter would hold a strategically folded newspaper. On their way back to Mitsuko's father's restaurant, and then she didn't know what. She'd done the thing that Hiromi hadn't wanted her to do, and got nothing for it but a vaguely unpleasant idea of Rez as someone capable of being bored. And where did it leave her? She'd gone ahead and used Kelsey's cash card to pay for the train, and now another train back. And Zona had said somebody was looking for her. They could track her when she used the cash card. Maybe there was a way to cash it in, but she doubted it. None of this had gone the way she'd tried to imagine it back in Seattle. But then you couldn't be expected to imagine anyone like Mary Alice, could you? Or Eddie, or even Hiromi. Masahiko frowned at the control face. Chia saw the dots and squiggles changing. That thing Mary Alice had stuck in her bag, right here under her arm. She should have left it at Mitsuko's, or thrown it away, but then what would she say if Eddie or Mary Alice showed up? What if it was full of drugs? In Singapore, they hung people right in the mall for that. Her father didn't like it, and he said that was one of the reasons he never invited her there. They put it on television, too, so that it was really hard to avoid seeing it, and he didn't want her to see it. Now she wondered how far Singapore was from Tokyo. She wished she could go there and keep her eyes closed until she was in her father's apartment, and never turn the TV on, just be there with him and smell his shaving smell, and put her face against his scratchy wool shirt. Except she guessed he didn't wear those in Singapore because it was hot there. She'd keep her eyes closed anyway, and listen to him talk about his work, about the arbitrage engines shuttling back and forth through the world's markets like invisible dragons, fast as light, shaving fragments of advantage for traders like her father. Masahiko turned, accidentally knocking her bag aside as the train stopped at a station. Not theirs. A woman with a yellow shopping bag said something in Japanese. Masahiko took Chia's wrist and pulled her toward the open door.
This isn't where we get off.
Come, come. Out onto the platform. A different smell here. Something chemical and sharp. The walls not so clean somehow. A broken tile in the ceramic ceiling.
What's the matter? Why are we getting off?
He pulled her into the corner formed by the tiled wall and a huge vending machine.
Someone is at the restaurant, waiting for you.
He looked down at her wrist, as if amazed to find that he was holding it, and instantly released her.
How do you know?
Walled City. There have been inquiries in the last hour.
Who?
Russians.
Russians?
There are many from the Combinatier since the earthquake. They forge relationships with the Gumi.
What's Gumi?
Mafia, you call it. Yakuza. My father has arrangement with local Gumi, necessary in order to operate restaurant. Gumi representative spoke about you to my father.
Your neighborhood mafia is Russian?
Behind his head, on the side of the machine, the animated logo of something called Apple Shires.
No. Yamaguchi Gumi franchise. My father knows these men. They tell my father Russians ask about you and this is not good. They cannot guarantee usual safety. Russians not reliable.
I don't know any Russians, Shia said.
We go now.
Where?
He led her along the crowded platform, its pavement wet from hundreds of furled umbrellas. It must be raining now, she thought. Toward an escalator.
When Walled City saw attention was being paid to our addresses, my sister's and mine, a friend was sent to remove my computer.
Why?
Because I have responsibility. For Walled City. Distributed processing.
You've got a mud in your computer?
Walled City is not anywhere, he said, as they stepped onto the escalator. My friend has my computer, and he knows about men who are waiting for you.
Masahiko said his friend was called Gomi Boy. He was very small and wore an enormous balloon-bottomed pair of padded fatigue pants covered with at least a dozen pockets. These were held up with 3-inch-wide day-glow orange suspenders over a ratty cotton sweater with the cuffs rolled back. His shoes were pink and looked like the shoes babies wore, but bigger. He was perched on an angular aluminum chair now, and the baby shoes didn't quite touch the floor. His hair looked as though it had been sculpted with a spatula, gleaming swirls and dips, like your hand might stick there if you touched it. It was the way they painted J.D. Shapley's hair on those murals in Pioneer Square, and Shia knew from school that had something to do with that whole Elvis thing, though she couldn't remember exactly what. He was talking with Masahiko in Japanese over the crashing sound surf of this gaming arcade. Shia wished she was wearing a translator, but she'd have to open her bag, find one, turn the sandbenders on. And Gomi Boy looked like he'd be just as happy knowing she couldn't understand him. He was drinking a can of something called Pocari Sweat and smoking a cigarette. Shia watched the blue smoke settling out in layers in the air, lit by the glare of the games. There was cancer in that, and they'd arrest you in Seattle if you did it. Gomi Boy's cigarette looked like it had been made in a factory, a perfect white tube with a brown tip he put to his lips. Shia had seen those in old movies sometimes, the ones they hadn't gone through yet to digitally erase them. But the only other cigarettes she'd seen were the twisted-up paper ones they sold on the street in Seattle, or you could buy a little baggie of the tobacco stuff and the white squares of paper to roll it up in. Meshbacks in school did it. The rain was still coming down. Through the arcade's streaming window, she could make out another arcade across the street, one of the ones with the machines the silver balls poured through. The neon and the rain and the silver balls ran all together, and she wondered what Masahiko and Gomi Boy were talking about. Gomi Boy had Masahiko's computer in a plaid plastic carry bag with quilted pink international biohazard symbols on the sides. It was sitting on the little table beside the can of Pocari Sweat. What was a Pocari? She imagined a kind of wild pig with bristles, turned-up tusks, like she'd seen on the Nature Channel. Gomi Boy sucked on his cigarette, making the end glow. He squinted through the smoke at Masahiko and said something. Masahiko shrugged. There was a fresh mini-can of microwaved espresso in front of him, and Shia had another Coke Light. In Tokyo, there was nowhere to sit down unless you bought something, and it was quicker to buy a drink than something to eat, and it cost less. Except she wasn't paying for these. Gomi Boy was, because he and Masahiko didn't want her to use Kelsey's cash card. Gomi Boy spoke again.
He wishes to talk with you, Masahiko said.
Shia bent over, unzipped her bag, found the ear clips. She only had the two, so she handed one to Gomi Boy, put the other on her.